12th chapter and look again at these verses that we read this morning. We've been seeing in the 12th chapter that Jesus is trying to be focusing the mind of his disciples on their need to be absolutely genuine as his followers, pointing out to them that there needs to be a fear, a holy fear of God in their life that will act like a gyroscope and a compass to keep them on course, living for God and not concerned what men may think about them. Jesus told the parable of the rich fool, who is a man who ignored that fear of God and ignored the eternal dimension in his calculations. And then Jesus turned to those who perhaps were not rich and he said, you know, you can get into difficulties too, because you can become so preoccupied and so worried about what you haven't got that you don't seek that treasure that's in heaven. So he says in verse 29, do not keep on worrying. And in verse 31, seek for the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added unto you. And in verse 33, sell your possessions and give to charity. Make yourself purses which don't wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near, nor moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And the impression that you get as you go through this 12th chapter is that Jesus is, as it were, trying to shake his disciples by the shoulders and say, look out of this world. There is an eternity before you. Now live in that eternal dimension. Don't be like the rich fool who only thought of the kingdom on earth. But seek first the kingdom of God. And now in verses 35 to 48, Jesus gives yet another encouragement to his disciples to shake them up, to think of living in the light of eternity and in the perspective of the sure fact that he is coming back. And he's going to come when you least expect it. Now he does this with two parables. The first is the parable in verses 36 to 40 of the watching servants, and the thrust and the emphasis of those is that we have to be ready. And the second parable is in verses 41 to 48, the parable of the faithful steward, where the thrust again is on faithfulness and accountability. I'd like us to look this morning fairly briefly at four aspects of what it means in the light of Christ's second coming to live in the light of eternity. Four things that ought to characterize us if we're really listening to what Jesus is saying in this 12th chapter. The first is that we have to be dressed ready for action. The second is that we have to be equipped ready for service. The third is that we have to be alerted, ready for departure. And the fourth is to recognize that we are entrusted and we have to be ready to give an account of our stewardship. The first then is that we need to be dressed, ready for action. That's in verse 35. Be dressed in readiness. Now, if you like the original language, you'll enjoy King James Version, the Authorized, because that says, let your loins be girded about. And that's the force of the Greek there. Now, I don't think I dare give you yet another demonstration of what it's like to go to bed in a sarong. But you see, Eastern robes are long flowing robes, and they hang around your legs and your feet. And the force of what Jesus is saying here is literally, you've got to have those robes girded up around your waist. Otherwise, you're going to be slowed down and you're in real danger of tripping up. These clothes that you wear about you must not be an impediment in your service for the Master. They must not be a cause of stumbling in his service. Your lifestyle, in a sense, must be one that befits a slave on active service for his Master. Those clothes must not be allowed to get down on your ankles. Gird them up. Now, if you turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4, you'll find that Paul is hammering home just the same truth using a different metaphor. He's telling Timothy that he's to be strong in the grace of Christ, to suffer hardship as a good soldier. And then in verse 4, no soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life so that he may please the one who enlisted him as a soldier. Do you see the word there? Gird it up so that you don't get entangled. And that's the word that Paul uses, entanglement. He's not saying you contract out of this world. He's not saying you avoid all secular activities and you don't get a good job and try to get on in life, or you don't have any hobbies. In fact, I think that a lot of Christians might do well to have hobbies, to broaden their interests, to have a healthy balance, to be able to take rest. Some people are greatly impoverished simply because they don't do that. And they don't look at all the wonderful things, nor get involved in all those things that God has put here for our enjoyment. But the danger is entanglement. Anything that I allow myself to let wrap itself around my legs and hinder me in my service for Christ. Paul says a good soldier doesn't do that. Jesus says you gird up that robe. You don't let it trip you up. You don't let it tie you down or hinder you. Now, clothes are essential. I'm sure we don't need to underline that. They're essential up here for warmth, especially on a day like this. They're essential for modesty. In the more tropical lands of the world, they're essential, in one sense, for sanity, because if you go out in the midday sun, as the average Englishman and mad dog will be, you would end up mad, too, in that heat. And the reason why in the East they wear the clothes is not to keep warm, but it's to keep the rays of the sun off them. They're absolutely essential, vital. But Jesus said they're to be girded up. They're not to become entanglements. They're not to fall around your ankles. They're not to impede your progress. They're not to trip you up in your Christian walk. Now, I think it's essential here that we don't judge each other. But I believe that, as the Bible says, we need to judge ourselves in what we allow. There's no condemnation of a legitimate, balanced, healthy interest in life and a positive attitude to our work. But if that interest in life, if our possessions, be they whatever they be, take the place where they consume our interests to such an extent that if we're honest, we have to admit that in real and practical terms, it's those things that we put before God. Not God's kingdom which has first priority. Then we are not dressed for action. You know, you set your hearts where you spend your money, where you spend your time, where you use your talents. Maybe what Jesus would have us ask ourselves this morning is, where is my heart? And the simple answer that he's given us already is, your heart is where your treasure is. It's where you spend your time. It's where you use your talents. It's what that thing to which you give yourself and your concentration, that's where your heart is. Now, Jesus says your heart is to be set on things that are above. Legitimate things must never be allowed to drop themselves down around us in such a way that we're in bondage to them. And if ever we lived in a society where we're in bondage to material things, it's this. Every time you buy a new mechanical device, you discover that there are a whole load of things you have to do in order to keep that device going. And if you don't, it won't work properly. And you add this, and you add that, and you add a car, and you add something else, and you add that. And all these things come around you, legitimate things, but they take your time and you give them your money. And Jesus would say, logically, then you're giving them your heart. to be dressed, ready for action. Where is my heart? I remember many years ago, the Javanese, who had recently become Christians in one area, wanted to build a church. And they immediately said, "But we have no money." Now, I'm not going into the pros and cons of this. I'm merely stating a fact that most people in Java smoke. And they spend a lot of money on smoking. And they said, "There's no way in which we would have money to build a church, but you come from the West and over there you've plenty of money. Why don't you give us some? You ought to be stewards of the riches that God has given to you." So one day we got them to do a little exercise. We got them to take out a piece of paper and to write down on one side of the paper their hobbies, their pastimes, their cigarettes, their cosmetics. Now we said, "Write down the number of hours per week you spend on these things." They did that. "Now write down the amount of money that you spend each week on these things." And they did that. Now we said, "Take another sheet of paper and write on that the amount of money and the amount of time you give to the service of God. And write across the bottom of that piece of paper this verse, 'Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also.' And underneath write this question, 'Where is my heart?'" Well, maybe we think we're too sophisticated to do something like that, but I wonder if you did it mentally as I was speaking. I wonder where my heart is. The Jerusalem Bible translates verses 29 and 30 like this: "But you must not set your heart on things to eat and things to drink, nor must you worry. It's the pagans of this world who set their hearts on these things. Your Father well knows what you need. No, set your heart on His kingdom." And so Jesus would have us unencumbered with things. He would have us have a healthy detachment from the entanglement of things and a holy attachment to Himself. For those of us who are parents, how vital it is that our children see that we hold lightly to our possessions here on earth. Not that we don't have them, but that we hold them lightly. Because if they don't see that, how are they going to hold strongly to the riches that are in heaven? Because you won't convince them with 1 hour in a church service. To be dressed, ready for action, living in the light of Jesus coming again. Then secondly, we are to be equipped, ready for service. And you've got that also in verse 35. "Keep your lamps alight, and be like men who are waiting for their master when he returns from the wedding feast, so that they may immediately open the door to him when he comes and knocks." I sometimes think, and that's perhaps the reason why I was trying to explain to the children, that our concept of a servant-master relation has more to do with the kind of fantasies that you see on television, perhaps from the Victorian era. But in a different culture, that relationship between those who serve you in the house, a very necessary thing in order to be able to survive within that culture, is a very different thing. It is generally a relationship where there is respect, there is a difference of role, and yet there is a living together in a real family sense, and a strong bond of relationship in a good household. And both the servant and the master work together with a mutual concern for one another's welfare. And you've got that beautiful picture in verse 37, that where the Lord comes back and finds that the servants working in the house have been faithful, then he will actually get down, as it were, and serve them. Therefore, the marriage of the master in a household such as that is something that has profound significance. And I speak from a personal experience of this, because I was married out of that context. And those that work and live with you in the home are eager. They want to know who the bride is going to be. And they're longing for the Master to come back from the wedding feast. Eager, diligently ready, with thoughtful concern for the welfare of the new couple as they come back. And within the context in which Jesus was speaking, lamps in the wedding ceremony had a particular significance. No electricity. So when you went out into the village streets and when you went out into the hillsides, it was like going off into the campsites late at night. No lights. The lights for the benefit of the procession were absolutely vital. And the ceremony in Jewish times was that the bridegroom would go to the house of the bride, the father's house, and bring the bride back from the father's house to his own. And that he would do accompanied by those who had lights. And this, of course, is what Jesus took up in that parable of the five foolish virgins. And the great tragedy of it was that amongst those people who should have been there with light, at the time when they were needed, at the time when it would be evidence that they were in fact a part of that beautiful, caring family, at that great moment of crisis, they hadn't got the light and they couldn't be helped. No doubt all 10 of those virgins were good friends, but in the event when the bridegroom came for his bride, there was no oil to borrow nor to spare. Each needed his own oil with which to meet the Master. Each needed to be prepared for that moment. And at that moment, when the Savior came, you cannot get faith or anything else from anybody else to help you. Ready. How absolutely vital it is that we live in the light of eternity. Because what we are now is vitally significant for what we will be then when he comes. Someone facing terminal illness in a hospital has a tremendous testimony, radiates Christ. So that the staff in that hospital come and they say, how do you get a faith like that? Or I hope that when I come to face the end, I can face it like that person. But you know, you don't suddenly get that kind of faith at the last minute, even if you're given time to think about it. As now, so then. Prepared. For when the Master comes. Because at that point it will be no good turning to a friend. It will be no good saying, ah, but my father has faith. It will no good turning to a Christian friend and say, give me something of what you've got. Because the faith of others can never be our resource. It's our own faith and our own personal walk with the Lord that will determine the issue when the bridegroom comes. Ready for service, dressed for action, alerted, ready for departure. Third thing. Because Jesus in these verses is at great pains to point out the unpredictability of his coming. You see, the whole parable and the whole situation was before the age of quartz watches. And by the day they would look at the sun for their clock. And by night it would be the biological clock. And events move slowly and unpredictably. And Eastern wedding feasts are absolutely nothing like wedding feasts in this country. And as I say, I've been through one. And they go on and on and on. And another person steps up to entertain the company. And somebody else comes along and a village comes in. And they've got a song to sing. And then dancers will get up and it will go on and on and you never know when it's going to end. And in some villages the weddings go on for days. But they do come to an end. Augustine says the day of his coming has been hidden that every day might be regarded. Now Jesus, as he goes on through this chapter 12, says, I want you to be able to discern the times you're living in. I want you to be alive. He says, you're absolute hypocrites. You're marvelous at talking about the weather. You're great weather forecasters. But he said, you don't discern the times you're living in. And his message again and again is, learn the parable of the fig tree. Because it indicates that the time is coming when the Lord is near, he's at the door. And you have got to be ready. And Jesus again and again gives us the times and gives us the signs of his coming. And he does it that some generation, sometime, will be able to recognize that he is near right at the door. I wonder if we are that generation. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, of famines and pestilence. If you say, yes, but that's been going on for centuries. Well, it has. And yet, has it been going on such a scale as we see it today? And if that's not enough to convince us, we're living in the age now where Armageddon isn't just a weird fantasy of science fiction, but it's the nightmare of the statesman. Because it's a possibility. For the first time, we have the necessary technological skills to destroy all life on this planet. We have now plucked the second apple of knowledge, as it were, off the tree. With that mushroom cloud. And no amount of ideological idealism can ever put it back again. Because we're now enlightened, for better or for worse. There now exists the technological data processing, financial processing to control one world system. These things are no longer an impossibility. And Jesus warned, he said, in those last days there will be false prophets and false messiahs doing signs and wonders. And the love of many will wax cold. You know, the opposite of love is not hate, it is self-love. It's love that's turned in upon self. And if ever we lived in a generation where people are taught to love themselves till society disintegrates, it's this generation. And even some Christian writers twist and distort the scriptures to get us to love ourselves. And I personally don't find it difficult to believe that we are in the last days. But we're not just to be alerted for his arrival, but for our departure. And whether or not Jesus will come back today or not, there is not one single day, nor is there one of us who can say beyond a shadow of doubt that he will not come back for me today. The fool was a fool because he left that out of his calculation. He lived as if it wasn't true. But God came to him and summoned him, and he said, this night. Now, if he came for me tonight, would he find me girded or impeded? Would he find me ready or run out of oil? Do the things that I have and the things that I do take so much of my time that as I try to jump up to the door to meet him, I find myself with a ball and chain? Am I sitting lightly to this world or not? You know, I believe the reason why Jesus spoke so strongly and so solemnly about these things was because he knew that there was an eternity. He knew the reality of eternity. He knew the unreality and the deception of time and this world we live in. And he knew that any man who lived and whose plans ended in time was but a fool. Irrespective of how clever that man was, how rich he was, how big he was in the eyes of his fellow men, in God's eyes the man was a fool. How would he judge me from my priorities? Am I dressed, ready for action? Am I equipped, ready for service? Am I alerted, ready for departure? Am I living really honestly in the light of his coming for me? Because the last point that I want to bring out of this second parable is the fact that we are entrusted and therefore need to be ready to give an account. In verse 41, you will see that Peter asked a question. Peter was always asking questions, and it's rather helpful that he was there to do it. Lord, he said, are you talking to us, that is the 12 disciples, those of us who really have special ministry, or are you speaking to everybody in this great crowd? Is what you're saying specially for the ministers and the elders? Putting it in modern parlance, maybe. Or is it meant for the whole congregation? And Jesus gives what we would call a beautifully Asian answer. He answers the question with another question. Who then, he says, is the faithful, sensible steward whom his master will put in charge? In other words, Peter isn't told specifically what he wanted to know, but he is told what Jesus wanted him to know. In other words, he says, what I say is true for every steward who is faithful and true, whether he's a minister or an elder or not, because in the household of God, all of us have a mutual responsibility to bear one another's burdens, even if some are set aside as overseers. And for those who are set aside for special ministry, he has a special word at the end of verse 48. From everyone who has been given much shall much be required, and to whom they entrusted much, of him they will ask all the more. Now Jesus uses here the word steward, and that's a different word from the word slave, although this man in the parable here, the faithful steward, is both a steward and a slave. Because in the households of people in those days, one man from among the slaves would be exalted to a position of manager, as it were, of the household. He would control the household and the marketing, the purchase of goods, the serving of meals. He would direct the servants in what they did. He would even control the finance, and all this he would have to do in line with the will and the policy that he knew would suit his master. That very same word is used by Paul in Titus 1:7 of the elders. For the overseer, or the elder, as it were, must be above reproach as God's steward. So this does apply to those who have office. But you see, this elder, this steward, in this particular paragraph, made two fundamental errors, at least. The first was he thought that he could do as he liked with the trust that was given to him. He ignored the fact that because he was entrusted as a steward, he was therefore accountable for what God had given him to do. There was a dichotomy in his life. In one part of his life, he carried out his duties for the master. But in the other part of his life, he carried on his duties and his life as if the master didn't even exist. In other words, he was not controlled by this eternal dimension, nor by the fear of God. Perhaps in our own situation, he was a respectable evangelical in all his pious pinstripes and clerical collar, at least when he was in public. But the rest of his life was totally unrelated to all that he professed. Now Jesus is saying that's just not on. That is not permissible in the one whom God will have as his steward. You cannot rant and roar at your wife and your children. You cannot give in to all sorts of self-indulgence and self-centered living and then think that you can come piously before the presence of God as if suddenly something happens when you step off the street from Buchanan Street. Jesus says it's not on. Because for the man who lives in the light of God's eternity, there's no such thing as a division between the secular and the sacred. That's what reflected in Bonar's hymn, "Fill thou my life, O Lord my God, in every part with praise, that our whole being may proclaim thy being and thy ways," not for the lip of praise alone, nor in the praising heart. We ask but for a life made up of praise in every part. So shall no part of day or night from sacredness be free, but all our life, in every part, be fellowship with thee. That man made that mistake. But the other mistake he made was he thought that there was always a tomorrow to put things right. Verse 45, "My master will be long time in coming," he said. Jesus, the faithful steward, said, "I must work for the work for him who sent me while it is day, for the night comes." In other words, there's no tomorrow in God's service. You work for today, you live for today. And one of the most effective sedatives in the demonic pharmacopoeia is procrastinatus manana. And for our friend who comes from the beloved land of Indonesia, Besok Aja. Tunggu besok. I have a real problem, actually, because we don't have tenses in the verbs in Indonesian. And in order to speak of the future, you very often use the word tomorrow. You put, "I tomorrow go." That means I will be going. And you use the word tomorrow in just that future sense, sometime future. And somebody says to me, "Will you do something?" And I say, "Yes, I'll do it tomorrow." And in 3 days' time, they come back to me and they say, "Have you done it?" And I say, "No, not yet." "Well, you said you'd do it tomorrow." "I'm sorry. Besok. Mañana. I'll do it in the future." But you see, there's a soporific effect in that, isn't there? Who knows whether there will be a tomorrow? You see, this is what Jesus is trying to drive home to us. Live as if this was the last day. Would you be malu, shy, ashamed, if this was the last day? Would I? Can I read what Jesus said in conclusion to that parable? "The slave," verse 47, "who knew his master's will and did not get ready or act in accord with his will shall receive many lashes. But the one who did not know it and committed deeds worthy of a flogging will receive but few, and from everyone who has been given much shall much be required. And to whom they entrusted much, of him they will ask all the more." Why didn't Jesus soften his words? Why was that warning so serious? Do you think he really meant what he said? I think we should answer by singing hymn number 663. Oh, for a closer walk with God, a calm and heavenly frame, a light to shine upon the road that leads me to the Lamb. The dearest idol I have known, whate'er that idol be, help me to tear it from thy throne and worship only thee. 663.